As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
To the Total Soccer Show, we're coming at you like Cleopatra with a listener question show today. My name is Ryan Bailey, and joining me today is a man who would melt down the Eredivisie trophy and give a piece to every TSS listener if he could, Taylor Rockwell.
I say we melt down all the trophies and give all the pieces to all the different fans. That would be a good way for all of the corporate owners to maybe generate some goodwill, because they all need it these days, it seems.
Don't they just? This story, of course, I'm referring to is Ajax winning the Eredivisie trophy and melting it down into 42,000 tiny pieces, champion stars, they called them, and shared them with all 42,000 of their season ticket holders. I'm just hoping this was a replica trophy, because
I did wonder that.
You know, say PSV win it next year. They're like, guys, all 42,000, you've got to send your piece back. We're going to melt it back into a trophy to give to Eindhoven. Sorry.
Guys, we've got 41,997. We know there are three of you out there. We need those pieces back.
The handle isn't complete. They're going to drop it. Please send them back. Joining Taylor and I is a man who loves soccer almost as much as he hates me asking him to predict the results in soccer. It's Joe Lowry.
You're so right, Ryan. You have that ranking exactly right. Taylor, I think as a quick suggestion, if we are trying to do this, TSS melts something down and gives it to people like Ryan talked about. I think it's just be either your mixing board or your mic, something that really has that TSS history, but it's also really useful for you and inconveniences you in a major way.
Perfect. I do have the old kind of burnt out mixing board where halfway through recording, we would realize the audio wasn't really working anymore. We could melt that one down. I don't really know how to melt down metal and plastic. I assume just soak it in gasoline and set it on fire in my kitchen.
Yes.
That should do it, right?
Nope, that's it.
Perfect.
Taylor, read the room. There's a gas shortage right now. We can't be wasting it on old mixers. Come on.
All right. I'll just use rubbing alcohol. No, there's no hand sanitizer shortages that I know of.
Give it time. Give it time. We'll see. But Joe, I do realize
it's a fun world we live in, huh?
I know. It's a different adventure every day. Isn't it wonderful? Yeah. Let's just, we'll all melt everything down and start again, just like Ajax. That sounds like the thing to do. But Joe, I realize I do always ask you to predict results, and it just makes me want to do it more every single time. But I realize you're a man who likes empirical data. And if you had harnessed and modeled that data for predictions, you would have already bankrupted every bookmaker by now. So maybe I should stop doing that.
No, Ryan, if it brings you joy, it also, to be honest with you, it brings me joy to kind of make a fuss about it. So I think this could be a really nice symbiotic relationship that we've got going here.
Okay, that's good. So who wins the 42,000 pieces of Eredivisie next year then, Joe?
Ajax. Yep, that's right, Ajax.
Yeah. They've really banked on that one, that's for sure. That's for sure.
That's I think he also said Ajax, 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 which would be three times, and I think that would be their third straight title. So well done, Joe. If anything, it's fitting.
Yes, that was intentional. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. I'm sure.
Well, gents, we have plenty to get on with today, apart from rambling about melted down trophies and the like. Why don't we answer some listener questions? What do you think, Joe? Listener questions?
Oh, I'm here for
it. I predict you're going to do well at them.
I'll go along with that. I'll go along with that, Ryan.
Let's get started then. Luke Carey has got the first question here. Thank you very much for submitting, Luke. No Josie or Bradley on the Nations League roster. Is this effectively the end of their national team careers? And if so, to quote Samwise Gamgee?
Gamgee, yeah.
Gamgee, I think, yeah.
What's that?
It's Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, one of those two. I don't know.
I've never seen Lord of the Rings
What's wrong with both of you? Neither of you cares about Harry Potter. Neither of you cares about Lord of the Rings. What's that watch?
This isn't a soccer player who's really popular, who I don't know, is it?
No.
Oh, that's good.
To finish off Luke's question, and if so, to quote Samwise Gamgee, I don't know why it makes me sad. He's referring to Josie and Bradley not being on the Nations League roster. Gents, I'll let you have at this one. Taylor, what do you think?
I think it depends a lot on what happens between now and when the Gold Cup roster is submitted, because as Joe and I talked about yesterday, with the Nations League, and then you've got friendlies sandwiched on either side of those two games, so you're going to have four games this summer, it does seem like Greg Berhalter is going to go with the strongest possible team there, and then according to some reports, that means he will not call up that strongest possible team and maybe will leave off a significant percentage of that team when it comes to the Gold Cup roster. So if Bradley finds form, if Josie Altidore comes back and looks like Josie Altidore, I think there's a chance we see them again in the Gold Cup. I think less of a chance once World Cup qualification starts, so I do feel like that Gold Cup could be their sort of final hurrah, their final send-off with the national team.
Yeah, I mean,
as Americans, can I, sorry,
no, you're fine,
Joe, can I ask you both, just to get an overview of these competitions, Nations League and the Gold Cup. The Nations League, which is, this is the 1920 competition, by the way, the semi-finals, I guess you call it, of it, they're on June 3rd and June 6th in Denver, with the United States taking on Honduras and Mexico and Costa Rica facing off in the other semi-final. Where do you rank these competitions in terms of importance? Like, do you have more of an affinity to the Gold Cup because you've known it longer, or does this feel like it takes precedent? Joe, why don't you come on that one?
I've got Nations League 1, Gold Cup 2, and I think that's how Berhalter's looking at it, which is why I have it ranked like that. In a normal year, maybe in a non-World Cup qualifying cycle, I don't know exactly how, or a non-World Cup qualifying year, I guess. I don't know how the U.S. approaches it, but right now, Berhalter and company have slated that early June, end of May timeframe to be their prep, their dress rehearsal, their trial run for World Cup qualifying starting in September, because they have multiple games in the windows now, or three games instead of two in the windows now. It's helpful for the U.S. to have a chance to actually work out those rotations, work out those reps. So for me, it's Nations League all the way. Taylor, I don't know where you stand on that.
I don't really think I have a clear preference. Like, I like the Gold Cup because I like tournaments and I think they're fun. This time around, I think I'm with you, Joe, that because it's kind of being treated, I think, as a good more of a tune-up for the World Cup, for World Cup qualifying than the Gold Cup. Combined with that, we have the Olympics this summer. The U.S. obviously doesn't, but other countries do, including Mexico. So I think we might get a weakened team playing in the Gold Cup from Mexico's perspective anyway. So I don't mind them playing, whichever one will give them the chance to play the stronger opposition, such as it is, I am down for that.
All right. Joe, let you jump in and actually get your opinion on Luke Carey's question there.
Yeah, I think Michael Bradley's national team career effectively is over, and it probably has been since, I think his last start was October 2019, and the U.S. has lost to Canada in Nations League. They lost that game 2-0, and since that time, Michael Bradley, and maybe even before that time, he's just lost a step. He's a defensive liability at this point, and I don't want to take away from all the things that he's done that have been beneficial to his club teams and to the U.S. men's national team in the past. He's one of the greatest U.S. men's national team players ever. But right now, with the midfield depth that this pool has, Michael Bradley's not an upgrade. He's not an upgrade over Jackson Ewell, which would kind of be his clearest path into the depth chart somewhere. So I kind of see Bradley as a testimonial guy. If he's going to get that last cap, it might have to be in a one-off situation like that. Josie might be a different situation, but there's always that gigantic question mark. Is he going to be fit? Is he going to be healthy? Is he going to be available? He's not available for Toronto FC right now. He's missed a bunch of minutes already in this young MLS season. if he does somehow, I don't really expect this to happen, but if he does somehow get back on track and is able to be fit for an extended period of time, then I think you really ask questions, or Greg Berhalter starts to ask questions of his forward depth chart. Is Jozy Altidore a better option than Jesus Ferreira, or maybe not Josh Sargent or Jozy Zardes, but Daryl DK? You have those four guys, Sargent, Zardes, DK, and Altidore, maybe battling for three spots. And it does become a battle. But if I had to put money on it, I'd say Josie's career is probably pretty close to done from a national team standpoint, just like Bradley's.
I'm going to agree with Joe. And I think he probably had a more realistic take than I did. I probably went for a more naive, optimistic take. But the weird analogy I will go with, one that I think will be near and dear to Ryan's heart, would be,
Is it about Samwise Gamgee?
It is not. It's about making tea. Does that help?
Much better.
Okay. Ryan, you know when, do you use an electric kettle or do you use your stove?
I use an electric kettle because I'm not an animal.
There we are. That's the correct answer. Well done, sir. But you know when you've like boiled the water, but then you've like, as one does, you forget you were making tea, and then you come back to the, and like, you know it's boiled, you know it's hot, but you haven't quite seen it boiling yet, so you make it boil again and it does it like right away. Do you know the scenario I'm discussing?
You know me very well, because I do that at least once a day, yes.
Me too. And I feel like that is how I feel about Jozy Altidore, that for the longest time he was the number nine until he's not. He's our starting number nine until he's not anymore. And I feel like that was him like constantly boiling. And now he's not that for me anymore. But to Joe's point, I think if he has that form and that fitness, the fitness being the issue, and is able to score a bunch of goals, I feel like he goes from hot but not boiling to boiling again. And he maybe could play himself back into contention for the Gold Cup. Maybe not for a starting spot as the number nine. I guess it depends on what other options do there. But I think Joe is also correct that Bradley is probably the more on the way out of the two, if not already out. And so I think Joe's right that it probably is going to be a weird one-off circumstance, or maybe it is just him being brought in for the Gold Cup, but it's as a depth option and like, you're not our starter anymore, but we'll bring you on and hopefully we get you some minutes. And I think that goes to the other aspect of the question for me from Luke, which was like, why does this make me sad? And I feel that way too. I think partially it's because it's the end of an era, that those are two players that I've grown up with. I've had around since what, 2006 or thereabouts, or 2010. And so, it feels weird, I guess 2010, and it feels weird that it's sort of the end of an era, but it's also because of COVID and because of the failure to qualify for the World Cup, it's another example of two very prominent players for the U.S. not getting the send-off that it feels like they deserve. Clint Dempsey is the same. Like, I think the last game he was around for was either of the games that the U.S. failed to really produce a result in World Cup qualifying, Landon Donovan being left off the 2014 roster, and then he does eventually get that final friendly, but still, it doesn't feel like we ever give those big-name veterans that big send-off. They don't get that moment to score a goal in the World Cup, and then that's the end of it. And so I think that's where maybe for me some of the sadness comes, is that it feels like we didn't quite reach the level that we thought we would with some of those players. And it's not to say that they were bad or disappointing. It's just that it didn't feel like this is the way it was going to end, as sort of a fade away instead of a massive explosion and then meltdown after that.
Yeah. The sadness might actually be literally the passage of time, which is which is quite a shame. And I like your kettle analogy, because you're essentially saying that both players have gone off the boil, which is a nice.
That's the better way to say it. Thank you.
Polite way of saying it. I looked at this as a kind of, in a more pragmatic, this too shall pass kind of way as well. Jozy, 115 caps, Bradley, 151. Jozy is 31 years old. I mean, it's not ancient for an international player, but as Joe said, there has only had a handful of minutes this season. And I looked at the roster, and there's only one other player who was born in the 80s, and that's Sean Johnson of NYCFC, who's not an outfield player. So you look at it in that perspective, then it's kind of inevitable that this would happen, and just happens to be the point when it did. And this did make me, this evoked memories of, like you said, with Landon Donovan being left out, but also David Beckham, when he was left out of the England squad in 2006, straight after the 2006 World Cup, Steve McClaren left him out, and he got left out another couple times after that. He sort of crept back in a couple of times again, but there was that feeling of, oh, Beckham's been part of the furniture for 8 to 10 years, and it's going to be really weird not having him around, and that makes me sad.
Oh yeah, and then he even like played his way back into contention for 2010, and then what, blew out his Achilles or whatever, and then was on the bench wearing a suit but not playing. So yeah, that's a good another good example of that, where it feels like, oh, maybe we'll get it. Oh, we didn't get it. Oh well.
Yeah, and it felt weird because after 2006, he was in Madrid. And then when he made the move in 2007 to the US, it felt like, oh, it's going to be tricky. England managers just can't see past their own coastline. So it's going to be very tricky for him to get back in this team. And he did manage to do so a little bit. So that was what it evoked for me. Is there any more on Luke's question there, gents?
No, I have talked plenty, so I think we could probably move on.
All right, let's go on to Matthew Anderson's questions here. It's MNT related as well. Which MNT eligible but never capped in the picture MLS players might we see in conversation for the Gold Cup roster? For the sake of this conversation, let's include YNT mainstays like the recent under 23 Olympic qualifying roster, maybe even some 25 to 30 year old guys. Taylor.
I went with the obvious names in the sense that they are teenagers. That would be Cade Cowell and Caden Clark are probably players that we could see. I don't believe either one of them has a senior cap at this point, but if they continue to play the way they have been, they are players that I could see in the conversation for the Gold Cup. That also goes for Leon Flock of the Philadelphia Union, who I think is 20. So not a teenager, but still young enough and has been impressive for Philly playing a number of different positions. And I think that versatility could be of service to Greg Berhalter. So those were three names I have. I've got a couple other ones, but I feel like Joe's got some solid ones too.
Yeah, I've got Eric Williamson, who I think Portland Timbers fans are still mad at me about for the whole.
Does he not have a cap yet?
I don't believe so. I think this U23 cycle was his first chance to break in. I mean, he's played for the U20s in the past. He's played at a World Cup with the U20s, then with the U23s, wow. And I thought he didn't. I mean, he didn't make that roster, but at the start of the season so far, he's looked really clean on the ball and looked like a player who certainly would have helped that group. So I have him. I also have James Sands and Keaton Parks, two NYCFC midfielders who just really don't seem to ever have gotten a look, or NYCFC don't care to release them. I don't know which it is, but those two players I think could both be useful in the Gold Cup. I'm sure there are others. I try to tackle the second half of Matthew's question, or I guess the second stipulation he provides there, maybe even some 25 to 30 year old guys. And I know there are others and probably goalkeepers that I didn't dig into, but the one biggest name that came to mind for me plays in a position of need for the U.S. national team pool for, you know, however long they've been around. Basically, he plays left back for FC Dallas. Ryan Hollingshead, he's right footed, but he plays on the left. He's positionally versatile. He likes to get into different spaces. Stop me if this sounds like something that Greg Berhalter would want. Hint, it is, right? I mean, he's a player. He's 30 years old.
Yeah, am I supposed to stop you now?
Yeah, whenever. I'm going to ramble here in like 3 seconds, so you might actually want to cut me off. But Ryan Hollingshead is very good. He's never gotten a cap before, and I think he could be a veteran guy to bring in to the Gold Cup, and you maybe get him some minutes. Maybe you don't. Maybe you leave those minutes for a younger guy. But I think he could be a useful player to have in that group.
The one depressing thing, which I will add to this conversation on this, gents, is, you know, when United States players get capped, they don't physically get a cap.
They should, though, right?
They should.
Mm. I had this conversation with Jimmy Conrade years ago. I was like, so where are all your caps? Like, do you keep them in a cabinet? And he's like, no, we don't get them. I was like, what? They didn't even give you like a baseball cap that you can put on backwards? Come on, this is America.
But this is where we need to clarify, because I think a lot of listeners will be surprised to know that that is where that term comes from. Or at least I was when I first learned that, because I always assumed career appearance, it was just a kind of combination to make it a cap, career and then appearance. So I was like, oh, that's just an abbreviation. I didn't realize that. Yeah, was it England who actually gave caps every time you would make the team?
I still do. Yes. And
you still do?
Yeah, everybody gets a cap. It's like an old-fashioned schoolboy cap that you get, and it has embroidered on it the name of the team you played.
That's where all the Brexit money was going. All that money that they were like, we're giving it to Europe, it was actually going to all your stupid hats.
Harry Maguire has a stack of them in his closet. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Do you need those? Come on.
Taylor, I laugh politely, but never call our hats stupid again, please.
I apologize. But yeah, that is a thing that I did not know, but is pretty phenomenal. I think they should get them, though. You're right. And I do wonder if you would have to, but then you'd have to like update them, and sometimes they'd be flat brimmed, and it would be a whole thing. I'm into it.
I mean, over here, they'd start having sponsors on them as well, wouldn't they? It'll get a bit much, I imagine.
They would never not have sponsors on them. That is correct. Joe, I had a couple questions for you about some players. Where do you think David Ochoa is in the conversation?
Ooh, that's a really, really good shout there, Taylor. He's on the Provisional Nations League roster. I'll be shocked if he actually makes that final 23.
Yep.
Which then leads me to think, okay, he did impress at the U20 World Cup. We can't let that one mistake against Honduras overshadow that in the game where the U.S. failed to qualify.
Some will, but we shouldn't.
We shouldn't. And I'm certainly not going to, right? That happens, and it's unfortunate. But he's still a hugely talented shot stopper, or he certainly has been in a lot of his games recently. I think he's a guy who could very well be on this Gold Cup roster. He's finally starting for RSL after a couple of years where it felt like he maybe should be starting, or he's dealing with an injury, whatever the situation might be. He certainly feels like a guy who should be included in that group, and even fighting for a chance to start if he performs well in that camp.
All right. What about Julian Araujo, who does have one cap already for the senior team, but was the only other player I could remember who looked solid in that Olympic team, or like solid enough that maybe they're ready for that next level?
Another guy I wouldn't be shocked to see in that Gold Cup group. I'm kind of just waiting personally for Julian Araujo to become a full-time center back and to become, he's not tall, but he could be a Gary Medel statured center back. I think his skill set is much more useful there than it is as a right back in most systems, certainly for Greg Berhalter. So that's more of just a random aside. When he does transition to a center back 8 years from now, I'll look back to this episode and pull it up and I'll look smart for once. But I think he's another guy who could be on that group, long story short.
All right. Because I think it's probably a recency bias here from the weekend review we did, where when they talked to Bob Bradley in the middle of El Tráfico, he was talking about how they hadn't done enough to contain Julian Araujo, and that's where I was like, oh yeah, he is pretty solid.
Yeah.
The last name, and we don't really need to go too deep on this one, is Efren Alvarez. It seems like that one's pretty much done, that he will end up representing Mexico. It seems like that's where we're going, but that is still a possibility, although a very unlikely one, but that's another one who I believe has one cap for Mexico, none for the U.S., obviously, and could still play, but seems very unlikely to do so. I'm ready for that one to end. I think Scuffed was tweeting about that. Bells was tweeting about that today, about how he's ready for that saga to end. And so too am I.
Yeah, it feels like that one's pretty much done. Obviously, you never know what could happen, but I would be very surprised if Efrain Alvarez plays for the U.S. over the next couple of months instead of Mexico.
And I blame Ryan for that, and I think that's fair.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think it's fair for me to be blamed for most things that are wrong in the world, Taylor. That's absolutely fine. I'll bear that for you. Matthew Anson, thank you very much for your question there. And thank you to Luke as well for yours. We're going to take a very short break now. I will go and quickly read the Lord of the Rings books in case there are any more references coming up in the next part.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We have a question here from Christopher Decker. Thank you very much for submitting, good sir. Why should fans of non-Big Six teams be happy that the fan outrage against the Super League has essentially maintained the status quo? Christopher's a Southampton fan. He points out that aside from those six teams, only Leicester has won the league in the 21st century, and only Newcastle, Leeds and Everton have finished in the top four. So wouldn't the Super League have meant more chances for smaller clubs? I've got some thoughts on this, gents. Joe, do you want to have a little stab at your answer here?
Well, so first I want to give some backstory. I was out for the week that all this broke, and I kind of was away from my phone, and I would check occasionally just refreshing my podcast feed, and it would be Ryan, Graham, and Taylor, and then it was, you know, Taylor and Snavely talking about this. And by the time I got back and was really kind of
Joe, can I just jump
underworld?
In? Just to be clear, you were on your mysterious trip to Turin with the Agnelli family, weren't you?
No, I was visiting my people in Porto. No, I was visiting my kingdom in Porto.
Oh, I see.
Come on, Ryan. But I kind of missed all of this in a really strange way. But I've done some reading. I did some listening. I edited the Allocation Disorder episode that Paul and Sam did, kind of giving them an American journalism perspective, an American soccer perspective on all of this. And I thought that was a fascinating episode. But my understanding of the Super League, and please correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, it wasn't necessarily going to pluck clubs from their domestic leagues, right? This league was supposed to be midweek competition for the Champions League. It was supposed to be the alternative where clubs had assurance of being in that league year after year and didn't have to worry about qualifying in their domestic leagues. And so with that being the case, as far as I understand it, the European Super League never allowed for clubs like Southampton to really do anything. Like, it wasn't going to change. It wasn't going to help them. It wasn't going to boost their ability to qualify for domestic competition, unless you're talking about Champions League spots, which I guess theoretically still could have been around, but I'm not sure how that all would have worked out. So I don't know that the Super League existing at all would really benefit non-Big Six teams. Ryan, am I way off on that?
No, I think you're on the right track there, Joe, and you make a good point. I suppose it depends on how seriously the threats of the Premier League and the big other leagues would have been taken to kick out these teams. And even if they hadn't, I think the point I would make is that European qualification, whether it be the Champions League or something else, is the carrot that you dangle in front of all teams. And if that carrot is taken away, what is the point? I suppose. What is the point for Newcastle, who famously only try and get mid-table every season and don't go for any cups? What is the point of them to try and go top four if there's no carrot there? I suppose that's a big reason why the whole thing would have ruined everything for me.
Well, there is the idea then that like the Champions League still would have existed, and so it's like the next best four. But even then, if you have the ninth place team making it because the other six teams are already going into the Super League, is it still the Champions League? Would there have been punishments for the English League for allowing that many teams to leave? Would there have only been one Champions League spot anymore? And then would it have been more an out-and-out fight? Would they have removed it entirely? Like, I think there's a lot of questions, and I think that is the big thing for me, is that as much thought as these teams supposedly put into the Super League and everything that would go into founding it, I think what I'm coming to realize, or have come to realize, is that there was a lot of thought put into how it would benefit these teams that were going to participate and what it would look like and who the potential advertisers would be and how would they get TV rights. I don't think they did nearly enough when it comes to figuring out what would have happened if they had left. And that's where there would have been issues in my mind, because if you're one of the many different TV companies that's paying a lot of money for the Premier League, and suddenly if they were kicking out those six clubs, well, you were paying a lot of money for those six clubs, the other ones as well, but certainly those big ones.
Right.
Are you now demanding some of that money come back? Or is the amount of money on hand going down? Are clubs going to suffer because they're not getting the funding? They're not getting the eyes on them that they were before? There's a lot of sort of, not even backlash, but just sort of repercussions that I think weren't really thought out. And a lot of that would have had serious ramifications, even if the teams had been allowed to stay in the Premier League. So I think that's the other thing, where it's less the status quo and more, I guess it is the status quo, but it's better the status quo than like potential destruction and maybe a tiny silver lining, but that being very unlikely.
Yeah, that's the crux of it, Taylor. So let's play out Christopher's scenario. Well, I'm not calling it Christopher's scenario, but the one he presents here, of these teams being leaving to go to the Super League. Yes, teams like West Ham and Newcastle, Leeds even, maybe they think they have a shot at winning the league at this point. There's a much more level playing field when a large chunk of the billionaire-owned clubs have gone out of the equation. In theory, that makes the Premier League more competitive. In theory, if you're in the playground and the bigger kids take their ball away and start a different game, it's more fun for the little kids who can actually touch the ball a bit more, if that makes sense.
But I
come back to the point, what would be the point of everything? What would winning the Premier League mean if those six biggest clubs in the country were no longer involved, in theory, if they weren't? And what would be that carrot or the reward, the incentive to actually win it? You know, the meaning of winning the English League title has meant those six teams, or variations of those six teams, have been at or near the top for like over a century. And that structure is completely gone. And it's a question of integrity, isn't it? It would ruin the integrity of the league structure, with potentially no top European contest to aim for those remaining clubs. Or if it was the Champions League, if that existed, it would be a much smaller competition with much less money involved. God only knows who would be in the Europa Conference League at that point. It'd probably be like the relegated teams getting in it then. But as you inferred there, Taylor, as well, it would mean likely a lot less money for the Premier League as well, a lot less TV revenue, if, in theory, these big teams did take off. So the standard of the league might get more competitive, but it would weaken as a whole, and it might become less engrossing as a, I use this word and I shudder, product as well for us to watch. So I think the outrage here is because it quite literally would have ruined the domestic game in many, many ways. And you can say the Premier League is inherently unfair, which is the point Chris is making here. It is unfair. Free market capitalism is unfair in many ways.
Yep.
But the alternative is anti-competitiveness. And that's against the spirit of why we all like this game, in my opinion.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, I will avoid getting into single entity because that will take us into another 15-minute long conversation. I will just say to one of your points, Ryan, about, like, so what's the incentive then? Like, what is the carrot for the team to still want to win the Premier League? If the Super League were in existence and making the money that it were making, let's say Leeds or Newcastle are the ones to benefit in that they become the dominant team in the Premier League and they win the league three seasons in a row. If they're still playing in the Champions League, but the Champions League isn't making the money that that Super League is, and then the Super League decides to expand, if you're Newcastle, you're probably trying to get one of those spots if and when they expand. And so if anything, the carrot is potentially getting into the Super League down the line, and then you're jumping ship. So it doesn't really solve anything. It doesn't create this ideal world, much as I wish it did, where everybody's equal and everybody's trying to participate, and we've kicked out the big money bullies. It's just who becomes the big money bully in the absence of the others.
Yeah. It would have ruined everything, is the long, is the short
much,
answer.
Pretty much.
Goodness me. Joe, you've got any, I feel like I've ranted for about 10 minutes on that. Joe, any more to add to that? Or do you want me to cool down a little bit?
Well, I just want everyone to know when we were first texting about which questions to answer and Ryan saw this one, he said something about being in a ranty mood already. So I'm glad that some of that has translated onto this show. I just keep going back to what I edited weirdly when I got back into the soccer world a little bit. On that allocation disorder episode, Paul and Sam were talking about how there's this continuum between competitive balance and league rules and salary caps and all that more American stuff on one side. And then on the other side, you have this pretty much free spending, asterisk, financial fair play, whatever, and kind of a lack of competitive balance on the other side. European leagues and the Premier League specifically are almost all the way towards that free spending side. And I do empathize with Christopher a little bit here. I'm not a fan of a Premier League team, but I can understand the frustration of where this is coming from. I don't have a solution to solve this and to better the status quo. But I think you guys are all with me on this. Like, there are real flaws with how the leagues are structured in Europe and how the Premier League is structured and how maybe there's a lack of competitive balance at times. I know, Ryan, you're talking about, you know, ruining the competitive spirit of this competition, but there are reforms that I think are needed, and I am just kind of glad that I don't have to be the one to think about that and actually put it into action.
Yeah, you're not the one who has to tell the billionaires they can't have as much power as
right,
they want.
Right.
Yeah, which is pretty tricky to exercise that one, which makes me always wonder how the campaign that United fans were talking about with the 50+1 rule being brought in, how they would practically apply that to people who have already in the hegemony of the billionaires. I think that's an interesting one. But for Christopher, who's a Southampton fan, I think on balance, Southampton are better off with the status quo than without it.
Yeah, as long as Liverpool keep buying their players for way too much money.
Well, you know what? Southampton would have solved, like, this all could have been solved for Christopher and Southampton if they just pulled the trigger and bought Weston McKennie this summer. So really, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy now looking back on it. That's kind of on them.
Well said, Joe. Well
said. All right. Christopher, thank you for the question. We're going to move on to a very serious and equally serious question from Jackie Choi here. In 2014, Graham Zusi was voted the hottest player in ABC News' World Cup hunk bracket. I missed that one.
Shocking. Shocking.
I don't know how that one escaped my attention. He narrowly edged out the other finalists, some guy named Cristiano Ronaldo. Yuck, yuck, yuck. They didn't run the bracket again in 2018, but if they had, who do you think would have won? I know you guys are straight dudes, but I'd love to hear your usual detailed analysis on such an important topic. And it is a very important topic, guys.
It is.
Okay, so I've got one name that stands out shining like a beacon in this one, but I'll see if anyone else says it first. Taylor.
Oh, I don't think I will. But what I have learned from this question is, number one, the lack of Italy at a World Cup has never been more devastating. I'll say that. number two, I've learned that I have bad taste in men. Because every single person that I thought was attractive for any number of reasons and said to my wife, she was like, ew, no, what are you doing? So she, for example, I was very confident that she was going to be like, why did I marry you when I could have married Olivier Giroud? I don't know if that's possible, but
ding,
I feel
ding,
like
ding.
That's...
there's the name.
She says no. She says no on Olivier Giroud, and I don't know really what to make of that one or what that means about my attractiveness to her.
I think that's a win for you, Taylor, somehow, in some world. Ryan, I also have Olivier Giroud on the top of my list. Yes. To actually get into that analysis that Jackie's talking about, I really went all in here. Well, not all in, but you get the idea.
Of course.
6'4". 6'4", so he's tall. He's got the jawline.
Do you have naked photos of Olivier Giroud? Is that what we're hearing?
I'm just going to keep
all the way in.
I'm just going to keep pressing on here. He's got that well-trimmed beard.
Joe Giroud, you know, it's something about, always sunny in Philadelphia with Charlie with his board and he's pointing at it and he's got all these pictures of Giroud.
All the red lines. Yeah. No, that's exactly what's happening here. He's got the beard. He's got the jawline, the nice fade. Margaret, I don't know what's going on here.
I don't know.
Yeah, Ryan,
I don't know. She's also the most attractive Manchester United players to her are Patrice Evra, sure, and Nemanja Vidic, and I don't know what to make of that one either. So, grain of salt with my wife's selections for attractive footballers.
Vidic?
Okay. No judgment.
She likes a man, Ryan. That's what I am assured by her.
that got Ryan good.
I like that. But I think Olivier Giroud was the bright light for me. I was thinking about 2018 as well. And this was a few years after his famous pictures appeared, which Joe has all over his wall now, with the when he was having his a dalliance with that model and he was in his very small underwear. So that would have coincided with this era. I had some other thoughts. If we're looking at World Cup players from that era, James Rodriguez stands out to me as well.
Yeah,
Radamel Falcao. Isco, surely a ringer in this conversation, I would say. And one other I would mention is this guy, Lionel Messi. He earned $111 million in 2018. And that is sexy. And this is also, I believe, before he colored in his leg with a tattoo that made it entirely one color.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you like the entirely one color leg tattoo.
Sure, you might.
I like Marcos Rojo's tattoo. I also like how much of a diligent father he is. So I had him on my list, but Margaret said no on that one. I had Mats Hummels. She approved of that one. Mats Hummels is a handsome man, facial hair or no. Long hair or short. It worked either way. And I'm going to say Ruben Loftus-Cheek has solid facial hair, lots of different looks, pretty fashionable. He's a handsome fellow as well.
Yeah, I'll add in two quickly here. One from our great region of CONCACAF, Carlos Vela. He's got great hair, usually a little on the longer side, which is kind of unusual, I think, for a lot of these guys. He can hit you with that smolder if for some reason that's happening. I don't really know what the case would be when that happens. But Vela and then Thomas Lemar, who was on that France team that won that tournament. Great looking guy. Great hair. Well-kept facial hair. Those are my submissions alongside Olivier Giroud.
I really do appreciate how much thought we all put into this, that like when you say Thomas Lemar, I'm like, oh yeah, for sure. That's not what I was expecting, but I'm cool with it.
And mentioning Vela has made me think on another MLS stint, Jonathan Dos Santos has got to be in the conversation for me as well.
Mm. He's got to be. Would Vela have made the team though? Or did he go? He didn't go, right?
No, he went. He went. He played well against Germany in that tournament, yeah.
Oh, you're right. Okay. All right. Then never mind then. Disregard what I said. Fernando Llorente did not go, but he was my other, like, if he were in there, he might be in the conversation as well.
We could go along this path for, like, a weird amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, we could. Yeah, we could.
Maybe we should part this, and we'll just, Jackie, we'll say, to quote Todd from Scrubs, TSS appreciates hot regardless of gender. So we are very comfortable having this conversation, and Olivier Giroud is the winning answer.
Did he say that about Colin Farrell? Because I think he did.
I believe he did.
Which is the correct take on Colin Farrell as well.
That was an excellent guest starring role that Colin Farrell had in Scrubs, I seem to remember.
I think it was the first time I ever heard him play Irish. That might be the only time he's ever done an Irish accent until in Bruges.
He was doing the very stereotypical Irishman. All right, lads, I got in a fight and I'm in here with this guy because I punched him out.
Oh, yeah. They literally made him do the Lucky Charms thing. They literally make him say, like, pink hearts, like marshmallows, all that.
All right. Well, that very serious question has been answered, Jackie. Thank you very much for that. We'll be back after these short messages with some more.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Total Soccer Show, we are back with your listener questions. Shreyas Ramani is back again with one. Thank you very much, Shreyas, for getting involved here. He says, the Premier League just announced that Alan Shearer and Thierry Henry were its inaugural Hall of Fame inductees. His question of the Premier League's active players, who do you think is a surefire Hall of Fame player? And he says, besides Sergio Aguero and Harry Kane, is this to assume they would definitely be included? Taylor?
I think it is, and I would say Sergio Aguero definitely is. I guess we'll have to see. I think Harry Kane needs like one title-winning season somewhere. But I think overall, yeah, I think for being a consistently good English striker, he'll be in there. I think for that reason, I have Jamie Vardy on the verge. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure, Ryan. I look forward to hearing your thoughts on that. The only one that I really felt supremely confident about would be N'Golo Kante.
Yeah.
For what he did at Leicester and then what he's done at Chelsea and everything in between, including, I know we're not supposed to consider other things, but also winning a World Cup. That gets just a little sprinkling, even if we're just talking about the Premier League. But mostly for what he's done in the Premier League with two different teams, I think he's number one on my list.
Taylor, our hive mind has come through there because he was absolutely number one on my list here. I had my notes say Leicester players, Vardy and Kante, yep. But Kante underlined two titles with two teams, four times in the PFA Team of the Year, won a World Cup and the Europa League as well to boot. So I think he 100% makes it, and he's still obviously doing rather well for himself. And Jamie Vardy, I think he makes it because of the story of Leicester City.
Agreed.
And his role in it, and because if this is a Hall of Fame, he's very famous and he's memorable and he's got a very memorable story, the way he's come up from non-league soccer, the way he infuses those Skittles with the vodka to help himself recover. It's all very, you know, it's all very Hall of Fame stuff, I would say, for Vardy.
And even the story, where did he come from?
It was Stonebridge, I think the club was it? Fleetwood. No, one of those.
Yeah, it was definitely Fleetwood in there. I forget. But like, yeah, the kind of where he was to where he is, that rise also, I think, is a narrative that they would want in the Hall of Fame.
Which is also true for Kante coming second division French team as well.
True.
And being poached to a league winning team. So yeah, Kante, absolutely. My other nominees I will put forward, Kevin De Bruyne, I think would certainly be up there. Maybe Virgil van Dijk. We'll see how he springs back from his current troubles. But, you know, having pretty big impact at two clubs, certainly won a title for one of them, almost on his own, one could argue, or his impact at that club was very, very mm-hmm. important for them getting that long-awaited title. An outside ringer as well, Gareth Bale.
Wow. You might have to make a case there. I'm with you on Virgil van Dijk. I think, yeah, maybe another season of him being the best defender in the world would do it for me. Gareth Bale, it's a tough one. Because isn't it, like, couldn't you argue that most of his success came when he wasn't playing in the Premier League?
Yeah, but you know, it depends. Is the Hall of Fame solely for actions taken within the Premier League? I suppose it is, isn't it? Because in that sense,
if it's the Premier League,
when you scored in several Champions League finals when you weren't involved in a Premier League team, maybe that does negate from my argument. But I was just thinking back to the Premier League years of around 2010, Harry Redknapp leaning out his Range Rover and Gareth Bale just banging him in for fun. And because he's got a good story of coming, you know, the fullback to basically a striker, which I think is a really interesting story as well. And yeah, I've talked myself out of it. Okay. Joe.
Yeah, so I had Jamie Vardy on my like possible list. Virgil van Dijk was on there as well. And then the other one, I would love to hear what you all have to say, because this might be too recent, it might be too soon, and it might be too personal for me, but I would say Marcus Rashford is in that conversation.
Yes.
If things continue.
Yeah.
I had him down on my shortlist too. Sorry to jump on you there, Joe, but just because of his impact off the field as well. And I know we're talking about Premier League Hall of Fame and the only things that happen in the Premier League, but his importance in the past year has, you cannot underestimate what he's done for society, basically. So I think as his path continues, he's very much a future shoo-in, Taylor. I like that pick.
And he's only, what, 23, I think? He already has over 170-something appearances for Manchester United. He has over 50 goals. So I think if he continues on, if he doesn't end up getting played to the point where he has no spine, which, like, I think he's broken his back or injured his back multiple times in the last like 16 months. But if he can continue, I think there's a chance that he also moves up the like all-time appearances record, maybe the all-time goal scoring record as well for Manchester United, which I think furthers him in that conversation.
And Joe, this is the point where you jump in and say the name of the player we've been missing and go, oh.
Pretend that I've done that, because I haven't. You all have taken the ones that I was thinking. I do want to... Actually, no, that's a lie. I do have one. But before I get to that one that hasn't been said yet, I want to go back to Kevin De Bruyne real quick. I think Sergio Aguero is a shoe-in. He's a surefire Premier League Hall of Famer. De Bruyne, I think, is as well, just because he is the player, more so than Aguero, for me, that embodies Manchester City's on-field approach and on-field excellence the best. I don't think there's any other City player that really is as Guardiola as Kevin De Bruyne is, and he's just been downright filthy good for the last several years. So I have De Bruyne, I had Conte. And then the third guy, Taylor, I want to get your read on this, is a Manchester United goalkeeper, David De Gea. I know he hasn't been himself, but I mean, he's been with Manchester United since 2011, and he was the guy for a long time. It might be a little bit less than surefire that Trace is looking for, but I think there's at least an argument to be made for him to be in that Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the problem for him is that he was so good at a time when Manchester United were not, that if he were playing, if he had gotten more opportunities in the Ferguson era where he had won some more silverware, I think that probably boosts him a little bit. But just the way he maybe ends up fading away, we'll see how things go. But yeah, like aside from that, I think that's a really good shout, because there were multiple years in which he was the best goalkeeper on the planet. I don't think that's just my opinion, but it might be. But either way, I think that's enough to get you in that conversation for sure.
And that kind of leads me to, I got stuck in a rabbit hole on this question, and I looked at World Cup winners who are currently active. Hugo Lloris, Paul Pogba, Kante, and Giroud. And if you look at World Cup winners who are no longer in the Premier League but still active, you've got Piqué, Steven Nzonzi, Jerome Boateng, and Mesut Ozil as well. So I don't know if I've added anything there, but that is to say, maybe Hugo Lloris was my tenuous tie to that conversation. Does he does he get in there maybe as a goalkeeper? Because if you think about De Gea, when he first joined as well, Taylor, do you remember how he was very much vilified and he was the flop?
Oh, yeah.
To start off with. Whereas, did Lloris have that journey? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I think he had a period of time when it was like, can he be trusted with clearance?
Driving?
Like crosses? I can't remember. Also, definitely driving. Yikes. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about Hugo Lloris. Because the one that I'm sort of on, I would be okay with him being in there. Ryan, I don't know where you are, but Raheem Sterling is another one that's probably worth mentioning. For, I think if he won the title with Liverpool way back when, in that season when it seemed like that was a thing they were going to do, and then he went to Man City and won all the silverware he's won, he's a shoe-in. Spelled S-H-O-O, I've now learned, not S-H-O-E.
Oh.
I tweeted that yesterday, but it's worth reminding. Yeah, I would say Raheem Sterling is also in that conversation for me. I also just kind of like him as a player.
I think that's fair. We're getting a lot of City players. And if David Silva hadn't retired, then we definitely have him in as well, I would assume.
Yeah, that's the other one. Yeah, David Silva. He also might have been in my most attractive players list as well. Thought about that.
Crossover with your wife?
her list.
I'll have to ask.
Let us know after. Shoot us a text.
Please do.
I have a feeling if I sent her a photo of Daniela De Rossi, she'd be like, yep, that's the guy for me. And that tells you maybe what you need to know. Hence why I've shaved my head and fully grown my beard out.
All right, Shreyas, I hope that answered your question. We did revert back to hunkiness there for a moment, but hey, it's our show. We can do what we want here. Next question, Trevor Lintner asks or says, Red Bull seems to have a super solid pipeline to bring players and managers up through the teams. Does City Football Group have something similar that is under the radar, or is it overshadowed by the drastic difference in quality between Man City and the rest? Or is that not their real goal like it is for Red Bull? I've got some thoughts here. Taylor, would you like to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. I think there's two things for me. I think the first is that they don't really need to have that model, essentially, because they have so much money. I think Leipzig do that, approach the way they do in Red Bull as a whole, approach it the way they do because they're not trying to spend the same money as an oil-rich state. I think they're trying to find ways to find value, develop that talent, and if they do end up selling it on, to make money off of that to then further reinvest into the various teams. And I think it's a sort of natural system that's a necessary system for them. For City Football Group, I don't think they have to worry about some of those things nearly as much. So I do think where their approach differs, this comes from an article called Inside City Football Group, which maybe everybody read. We'll find out. But in there, Don Dransfield, who's the director of operations and development at City Football Group, said this, and I thought it was pretty telling. In very practical terms, what that means from a footballing perspective is it means we're able to have more scouts in more places who are watching more games of more players and collecting better data and information to allow us to be able to make better investment decisions on those players, end quote. And I think what that means is that essentially they have scouting networks that one scout is looking at players for every City team, or like maybe multiple City teams. And it's, is that an NYCFC player, or is that a Manchester City player, or maybe it's the starting somewhere and then going to another. I think that is how they approach scouting. And I think it is different than the sort of linear progression, the start here, move here, move here, eventually go to Leipzig, or eventually be bought by Bayern Munich. I think this one allows them to have more of a footprint, and if they end up selling on smaller players, they do sort of turn a profit in that way. But I think overall, they're not trying to develop them because they have the money to just go out and buy, you know, £60 million fullbacks a couple different times.
It is interesting, Taylor, because when the City Football Group, the pattern emerged of what they were doing. They've got Man City, they've got NYCFC in the US, they've got Melbourne City in Australia, Club Atletico Torque in Uruguay, and they've got Girona and Yokohama in Japan in minority stakes there. And it did seem like they were going to try and do that Red Bull thing, moving players between clubs, but there hasn't been a lot of crossover. Like Jack Harrison, probably an example of a player who crossed over. There was a Brazilian defensive midfielder who went to Girona because he couldn't get a work permit. There's been like work permit reasons why that has happened for certain players as well. So it's not quite the pipeline. But they have also created their own pipeline within Man City with their own youth system as well. You know, Foden coming, being a very famous one to come, and maybe the only player who's come through properly locally. He's from Stockport, which is near Manchester. But you've got players like Sancho, Eric Garcia, Brahim Diaz, Iniesta, Taylor Harwood-Bellis, Tommy Doyle. There's lots of someone used to write about City's youth soccer for the Athletic, as I can reel off those names. But the model isn't quite the same. And I think you nailed it in your first sentence, Taylor, when you said it doesn't have to be, basically. They don't need it. They don't need it as much. And there is, as Trevor says, a drastic quality difference between the sides, which makes it less important. It makes their model less reliant on such a thing.
Yeah, I thought about this using a giraffe. So buckle up, everybody. If you think about a giraffe and just a regular human, you've got the giraffe head and then the really, really long neck and then the shoulders. And then on the human, you've just got the head and the neck and the shoulders. I think we can picture that pretty clearly. City Football Group is the giraffe and Red Bull is the human. And City Football Group, Manchester City, is the head of the giraffe. And then there's this really, really big gap between the head and the rest of the giraffe's body. And the rest of the giraffe's body is NYCFC, Melbourne, and all the other umpteen clubs they have. For Red Bull, it's just the head, which is Leipzig, and then the shoulders is probably Salzburg, and then maybe the stomach is Red Bull New York, and they have a few other ones, right? But it's just that idea that you're getting at, Taylor. There is just this massive gulf in class that has been created by money, from the head of the giraffe to the rest of the giraffe. So I think Trevor honestly gave us the answer in his question. And I think between the three of us, we've fleshed that out rather well.
I've got to call it up there. I'm not sure giraffes have shoulders.
Yeah, okay. Fair. I don't know what giraffes have. I'm not a biologist.
But you know that you should be a biologist to know that. So I think that's a credit to you, Joe.
Yeah.
I think that analogy does make sense, because even a player, like one of the players they tout as being a success would be Aaron Moy, who Melbourne City FC purchased. Then he gets brought to England, loaned to Huddersfield, eventually sold. Mm. And I think that is a good idea of maybe where their model is maybe you'll get that rare occasion when a player comes through. But yeah, is Yangel Herrera, is Jack Harrison, are they going to play for Manchester City outside of maybe preseason friendlies? I doubt it. So I think you have more of a, we'll develop some players to sell on or to move within those other clubs. But for Man City, that's not really what we're trying to do. I think fundamentally they just want a lot of different clubs that are all City connected. They talked a lot about how they want sort of seamless connectivity around the world, which seems like an optimistic or a very sort of grandiose plan, but also seems to be one that they're actually executing at the same time.
Yeah. And I'll add just for a bit of flavor that City Football Group also do share executives throughout all the different clubs as well. They do move around a reasonable amount, and they sometimes end up at the giraffe's head of Manchester City if they're lucky enough. Shall we move on to our final question, gents? How about we do that?
Sure.
Dallin Christensen asks, for teams looking at young US players, is it better for those players to be more positionally flexible, i.e. Weston McKennie at Schalke, or to be excellent at a single position, i.e. Weston McKennie at Juventus? I feel, says Dallin, like a player like Gianluca Busio is not as viable of a prospect because he plays so many positions. He loves the show, he'd like to add, but I don't like reading out compliments, but I did it anyway. There we go. Taylor.
Can we let Joe go for this one?
Please do.
And then I will piggyback on what Joe says.
So I guess I kind of disagree with the premise of this question down a little bit.
Oh boy.
I think my response, it's not really an answer to the question, but my response to the question is, I'm not totally sure it's possible to have a non-positionally flexible player at this point, maybe outside of a center back or a six or a striker, right? Looking at Weston McKennie as an example, yeah, he played everywhere at Schalke, and that was a little bit crazy, right? Maybe too far to the end of that extreme. But at Juve, he's still doing a whole bunch of different things. He's still starting wide, tucking inside, defending wide, you know, moving back and rotating in possession. He might not technically be playing eight different spots over the course of one season, but he's probably playing three different spots over the course of 90 minutes, right? So that still is positional flexibility. So I think even looking at young US players, and you can apply this to any sort of scouting or any sort of player, you know, prospect searching or whatever you want to do, I don't think there are a lot of non-positionally flexible players outside of those spots I mentioned. Caden Clark, Cade Cowell, we've talked about both of those guys on the show already briefly. They play all sorts of different spots over the course of 90 minutes, and they are even more flexible than a lot of other players their age. And Busio, I don't think Busio's not a shoe-in prospect because that was a really confusing way to phrase that. Let me try that again. Busio isn't a shoe-in prospect in my view, but that's not because he spent time at four or five different spots for Sporting Kansas City. It's because he sometimes makes poor decisions with the ball, sometimes shoots when he probably should pass, sometimes doesn't pass when he should, right? I mean, it's these technical issues, these decision-making issues that I think are Busio's flaw specifically. So I don't think I answered that question, but that's kind of how I look at looking at younger players as they're going to develop into more established pros.
Yeah, I would echo that. I would say that I think it's tough to find a young player who's locked into one specific position. And I do think to some extent that if you do have that, it makes them less attractive to a coach, in the same way that you often hear in a job interview, like, I'd rather have somebody who I can train myself versus a person who's coming in and thinking they know exactly how everything works. And I think that extends here. It's why there wasn't as much interest in Jordan Morris or Paul Areola, Jordan Morris especially, when he was looking to go abroad, why he ended up in the championship is because German clubs want younger players who are still pretty raw, have lots of ability, but they can be molded into what those clubs need. And I think that's what a lot of scouts and a lot of European managers are looking for. And that's where American players, I think, continue to be desirable, especially young American players, because the things you tend to hear about them are that they're very coachable because they're taught to listen to instruction and listen to what their coach says. They don't always have the best coaching, certainly, but there's still this idea that you're listening to your coach, you're playing in a system. And I think that is a very common thing across American soccer players, and it tends to be a thing that makes them attractive. So too does the work ethic and the willingness to do whatever's asked of them. And then there is a little bit of the chip on the shoulder that everybody knows an American coming in is like, oh, do you play soccer? Oh, you call it soccer. Of course you do. Like, there's those three things I think are big factors when scouts are looking at American players, and then the raw assets as well. But I think all of that ends up being, once you're in training, where do you fit in and what can you do? And like, Weston McKennie is an example. We saw him with Schalke playing as a right wing back, a right back, like a number six, a number eight, a number 10. I don't know if we ever saw him as a right midfielder, which is where Juve keep using him. And so, or a wide midfielder. And so even there's a lot of similarity, but I think there's flexibility that allows coaches to utilize different players in different ways. And I think that probably helps them when it comes to getting scouted and getting signed.
I think you both have nailed it there, but I think in general, it's a nuanced question, and it depends on the player. It depends on the position of the player, and it depends on the coach as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if one of these players went to play for Pep Guardiola, you're going to be a fullback at some point. So, you know, that's, you've got to be flexible there. And then you look at players who are very good at a single position, and it strikes me from the last weekend, Vinicius Jr., very good as a forward and being made to play as a wing back. Not so hot in that position. So it does depend. Because if you do, you guys ever buy the body wash and shampoo when it's combined? Sometimes in the gym you'll see like body wash and shampoo, and it's in the same bottle. No, you want the specialty. You want either the body wash or the shampoo. So it depends.
Yeah, I don't trust 2-in-1 conditioner shampoo either for that reason.
Exactly. And Vinicius is very much he's the body wash or the shampoo. He's not the combined, whereas some players might be. And I think it depends positionally as well, because, you know, a lot of time wingers tend to be wingers. They don't move around a lot. Strikers tend to be strikers. But, you know, there's some midfield nuances that can change. And as I say, if you're coached by Pep, you will end up changing position whether you like it or not. So it's an interesting thought, but it's also a very nuanced question, which depends on a lot of different factors.
And I know that every player, like literally every player, even if they're known for one thing, has at some point done different things. Like they've played as a center back and then they became a forward, or they played as a goalkeeper and then became a midfielder. The only one I have a hard time ever believing did anything other than what he does right now is Robert Lewandowski. And I'm sure he was a midfielder or a center back at some point, but I just like to think that he was born and immediately like scored a goal from inside the 6-yard box. And that was how it began.
Wasn't Manuel Neuer a striker at some point as well?
Yeah. I think that's a common thing, right, with goalkeepers and strikers, that there's a little bit of interchange because there's the height thing. You want a tall one, but also, like, the idea, at least when I was playing, was if you're a goalkeeper who used to be a striker, you sort of know what they're going to do. That never really made sense to me because what they're going to do is shoot the ball at the goal. Like, that seems pretty common. But yes, I think there is an overlap there as well.
I recall when David James was at Portsmouth, he was brought on as a sub as a striker.
Ooh.
For late in the game. I don't think it paid off, but hey, it was fun.
I mean, I will say that Manchester United's greatest ever goalkeeper is John O'Shea. Saved a penalty. That's all it takes.
Sure.
He'll be in the Hall of Fame. Let's put him in the Hall of Fame.
Peter Schmeichel raising an eyebrow as he listens to the Total Soccer Show listener questions there.
Grinning while debating. That seems to be his MO on TBS's coverage.
Praising the Glazers.
Oh. Yikes.
That's a whole other conversation, but I think, Jez, that just about wraps up our listener questions. I will say, I think you've both done an outstanding job of answering these listener questions. You both deserve a pat on the back. If I had a trophy in front of me right now, I'd melt it down. I'd give you both a huge chunk.
Aw. Thanks,
I mean,
Ryan.
I appreciate that. I mean, that said, I think a real friend would actually melt something down and send it to us, but please don't do that. Please don't do that. Never mind. I changed my mind.
I think practically speaking, I'd just maybe keep the trophy and let you share it maybe so it was still a trophy and not a melted down piece of metal. But hey.
I just got nervous because when I think melted down metal, I think either like mercury, like as liquid metal, which will then make me go crazy, or I think the T-1000, the liquid Terminator, and that scares me too.
This
I don't need Robert Patrick. Robert Patrick in my life, I don't need. So yeah. Well, we've reached the end of the show when the randomness ensues. So yeah, maybe that's a good point to end on.
Taylor, I hate to break it to you. I hate to break it to you. Yeah, we've been doing this the whole time, man. The whole time.
Yeah. I like that you both were scrambling to get that joke in first.
All right, let's the giraffe talk and the metal talk ends now. Taylor, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate you.
Oh, thank you all. Sorry.
Joe Lowry, a wonderful time has been had by us listening to your dulcet tones. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Bye!